Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. True crime is a genre that dominates TV, streaming, books, and podcasts with the capacity to challenge the criminal justice system, question convictions with weak or compromised evidence, but it can also re-victimize those who suffered and propel infamous killers into this warped kind of celebrity. A new podcast is approaching one of the most heinous crime sprees in California with a different lens that puts victims and the nuances of detective work into focus. The Hillside Strangler gripped neighborhoods in Los Angeles in the late 1970s. More than four decades later, a podcast is revisiting the longest murder trial in U.S. history, described as a story of crime, but also politics and personal redemption. Joe Redotta is the creator of the Hillside podcast and will be taking part in a live discussion at Sacramento's B Street Theater this weekend. Welcome, Joe. Nice to see you.
Thanks, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Well, Joe, what sparked revisiting an infamous murder spree more than 40 years later?
Well, I had this sort of youthful interaction with the case in 1990. I was working as an opposition researcher. That's a person in the political system who's sort of the unauthorized biographer of the opponent. And the my candidate was a Republican senator. His name is Pete Wilson. But the expectation was that John Van de Kamp, who was the sitting attorney general of California, was the likely nominee for governor. And that was sort of this era of the concern around crime was really driving California politics. And here was somebody who was elected attorney general in 1982 and reelected in 86. But as the district attorney prior to all this, he had made a really big decision in this case, and that was sort of haunting him. And my challenge was to sort of work against the press bias, which was, oh, this has all been litigated before. And so part of my job was to try to understand the Hillside Strangler case and to figure out, was there something new that could be said about it at the time that would illustrate Van de Kamp's role in this? And what happened was, is he didn't survive the primary. You know, Dianne Feinstein took him out quite handily in 1990. And so I had all the stuff that I had collected, and I just, luckily I didn't throw it away. I put it and sent it off to Stanford's archives. And so when I was thinking about new stories to explore, I worked on the Chessman case and some of it. I thought this is a story that I really knew well at a time, when I was basically 30. And now what happened if I went back to it? And what could we learn, today that I didn't know then?
Yeah, and we learn a great deal. I mean, just revisiting and just refreshing on this terrible crime spree. I mean, I'm from Eagle Rock, so I'm familiar in Los Angeles. I'm familiar with so many of the areas where these women were found. And this took place in the late 1977 into 1978. I'm just curious because, you and I chatted about this earlier that, true crime has kind of exploded as this genre, which can be investigative and it can fuel change. But then there's also the argument that it can exploit victims and terrible crimes, victims who often are no longer with us. What conversations did you have with your colleagues about striking the right balance and reducing harm?
Well, I didn't want to center the killers. It's sort of one of the standard formulas of true crime is let's get to know the killers and sort of follow them from fourth grade to the killing spree. And I decided not to do that, not to center them, and to sort of have the listener have the same experience as if you lived in Los Angeles in 1977. Things are happening around you, and you don't know who's behind it, right? And so I thought that would be really a more realistic way to do it. And then when I was doing the research on the story and pulling all the news articles, I came across a story in the 80s, a few years after the trial concluded, and a movie was being planned. And the families reacted very negatively to that, and they felt that they would be re-traumatized. And so I really, really sort of digested that, and I thought, I need to tell this story in a way that does not re-traumatize the friends and the families of the victims, many of whom I spent a lot of time with. And so in this show, there's no graphic description of the violence that was done to these women. I intentionally left it out, and I focused on them as people, and so we get to know them the gap they left behind when they were taken from their friends and family. And then, you know, for the true crime listener who wants to know, like, how is the case solved? How is it prosecuted? I really concentrate on the evidence that drives the jury verdict and drives the investigation.
Yeah, and you've had really positive responses about from the podcast about that specifically, about focusing on the victims and approaching this podcast, which is true crime, but in a more, I think, balanced and sensitive approach. You also have really important disclaimers, you know, before you start the episode. I was listening to episode one, just about outdated language, you know, and also for me, like taking a look at media coverage of the time and also the argument of devaluing certain women over questionable morals.
Right. So there was a theory early on in the case held by most of the investigators was that the killers were targeting a very, very vulnerable population, which is sex workers in Los Angeles. And these would be women that could be easily grabbed, could be pulled into a car, taken somewhere, beaten up, killed. And the killers were, you know, this was like easy prey, right? And this was, you know, there was some sense of that early on, and it was like a theory that the detectives had, and that sort of like colors the whole press coverage of it. And then what happens is when the killers expand beyond that population, the media start thinking, well, maybe this woman also has this secret life or something like this. And so when I interviewed one of the best friends of Lisa Kasten, who's in the podcast, and she was a dancer with Lisa, and she said, this is nonsense. And, you know, it was really, really offensive to me to have the detectives sit and ask me these questions about Lisa. But then there's this other thought I, you know, have after completing the show, which is, you know, why was there team A and team B? You know, it was really unfair at the moment to say, well, you know, these women over here are sex workers and these other women were not sex workers. And it's really unfair to describe them that way. You know, each of these women was loved, was a person who, you know, people cared about. And in the case of the first victim, Yolanda Washington, you know, her legacy was, you know, this legacy of the media coverage and, you know, that moment really weighed upon her family after she was gone. And one of the big surprises in the show was that Yolanda's daughter found me while I was working on this case and wanted to, you know, she was on a journey to try to figure out what happened to her mom and what was the impact of her mom's life and death on her. And then she finds me and then we connect and she tells me her story in the show.
Yeah, I mean, you're correcting harmful perceptions of those who can't speak for themselves anymore. When you were able to connect with the loved ones of victims of those who were killed, how are they doing? How are they? I would just imagine they are still shaped by this.
Yeah, they really a real sense of loss, a real desire to describe these women in full, and to share the joy of the friendship that they experienced. And then in some of the families, in one family in particular, I won't name them, the brothers and sisters was like, we just can't talk about this. Our mom just insisted at the time that the media onslaught around this was so horrifying and that our parents shut down and we were instructed never to talk about it. And we just still can't do it.
Yeah. And we're talking about victims who are as young as 12 years old. These are all young
Right.
women,
right.
and not, some not even women. I mean, they're still teenagers.
Yeah, middle school and up. Yeah. The killers were Angelo Bono, who was older. He ran a car upholstery shop in Glendale, and his cousin, who was in his 20s, named Kenneth Bianchi. And so at the time, before the arrests, there's no idea. There's a sense that there probably are two killers, but the public is being told through the press there's one. So it's the Hillside Strangler, even though there's two of them. Together they kill 10 women in Los Angeles and they break up. And then a year later, Kenneth Bianchi is arrested in Washington State for killing two more women. And that actually is what unravels this mystery. The investigation itself in 77 and 78 failed. They had no suspects. They had no leads. The killers looked like they were going to get away with it.
Hmm. Given that this started for you, the inception was, 30 years ago as an opposition researcher, do you view this trial and these crimes differently, or has it evolved because of this podcast and your work on the podcast?
Well, working on a project like this, it really changes you to go through these experiences. I mean, I interviewed like 50 people, and at all steps of the process, the investigators, the prosecutors, defense lawyers, the judge, et cetera. And I kind of, when I approached, I was sort of thinking, well, this is, there's not much new to tell. Like, there's nothing new here. I'm just going to maybe revisit it. But when I return to the case, there are 10 murders, but there are only 9 guilty verdicts. And so I thought, well, that's one of the questions I can unravel here. And so I really concentrated on trying to figure out why was there an anomaly. And I was fortunate that I could sit down with prosecutors, defense. They could all explain that. And then the other thing that I had the advantage of that, like the big book about this from the 80s didn't have was a lot of material has come to light since then. So I had all of Kenneth Bianchi's arrest records and the investigation files from Washington State, which are really riveting and horrifying. And then I also have his parole. He's still alive, and he attended some parole hearings over the years, so I have all those transcripts. And then, in a big surprise, the family of Daryl Gates gave me his personal files on the case. So Daryl Gates was LAPD police chief, very famous. But before becoming chief, he was number 2, and he ran the Hillside Strangler Task Force. And so they just handed me like 2 wow. grocery bags with everything, with his handwritten notes, call information, et cetera. And so you can see, how he's approaching it, what he's asking people to do. And when as I mentioned, the investigation is unsuccessful. And one thing was really fascinating was sometime in 78, he asked an outside group to come in and audit what had gone wrong and report to him, like, why didn't anybody find, why have we failed to find these killers? And there was only one copy that survived, and they gave it to me.
Well, and I imagine that's in the podcast, and your podcast is going to be complemented with a live component this weekend.
Right.
It's an upcoming discussion at the B Street Theater in Sacramento. Just finally, what will this add? What can people expect?
Well, Edie Lambert from KCRA, who also a Southern Californian and remembers the case growing up, she and I will be in conversation about the case. I'm going to show some videos that we acquired. It was really fascinating. This is an era where local TV sort of evaporates. It wasn't really saved, but in this case, the wife of one of the prosecutors was recording on the VCR every night how the trial was going, so she could show her husband that night. When he was on the evening news. So I got this incredible archive of local news. So we're going to show some of that, and then we have on the show a guest who is in Sacramento. One of the big interviews in the show, his name is Jim Mitchell, and he, for many years, was an investigative reporter in L.A. For radio and for the CBS News affiliate, and he's now retired up here in Sacramento, and I interviewed him about the case, and he had just some phenomenal stories to tell, so he'll join us in the conversation as well. And it's not just for people who've heard the podcast. We're going to cover the whole case, and there'll be a good introduction to the Hillside Strangler case. Hopefully might inspire people to then listen to the podcast or watch the documentary series on Peacock that I was involved with. And also there will be opportunity for audience interaction, and we're recording it, and we will make it an episode of the podcast.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vicky.
And we have all of that information on our Insight page. Joe Rodota is the creator of the Hillside podcast and will be at Sacramento's B Street Theater this weekend. That's it for Insight today. Have a fantastic day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.